Good evening. Welcome to, I think this is Sunday Night Live. I saw that in the bulletin. Oh my goodness. And I was so tempted to start out and say, the Abrahamic covenant has these important traits. And you got to remember this thing about the Abrahamic, and then talking for a couple of minutes about the Abrahamic covenant. And then saying, but the final thing you have to remember about the Abrahamic covenant is live from Roseville. It's Sunday night. I just thought it'd be great. I have nothing wrong with the name. I just that popped in my head. And then I didn't want to do that because I thought you'd be like, what is he doing? So I explained what I wanted to do. So he wouldn't be like, what's he doing? He'd just be like, why did he share that? And it's because I have a microphone. All right, Genesis 12. I'm going to backtrack real quick. Genesis 12, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I show you. And I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and make your name great. And so you shall be a blessing, and I will bless those who bless you, and the ones who curse you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. So Abram went. The next 13 chapters are all about Abraham, or Abraham becoming Abraham, which sounds close because it is. And we see over those 13 chapters his struggles to trust God, to trust these promises of God, in a series of trials and events and circumstances that really tested his faith. This is what Abraham was told. His initial act of faith was he went. And the next 13 chapters develop that. They develop his faith. God gives more promises. Abraham struggles to believe those. There's times where he believed those, he accepted those, he acted in faith. There's times where he acted like a fool. Hey, we're going here, I know you're my wife, but let's pretend we're sisters, right? That's a good idea, and just these boneheaded things to do where he just really missed the mark. But as that develops through the narrative, we come to chapter 22, where Abraham is given his ultimate test of faith. Was to sacrifice Isaac. And I'm not going to go into this a lot because I think it was covered last week. But I couldn't get it online because it wasn't up yet. And that's kind of the climax of the Abrahamic narrative. That's where he finally, everything comes together. And that's his ultimate test, and that's really the climax. And from there, it's kind of falling action. Abraham trusted in God's promises. The author of Hebrews puts it that Abraham believed that God could even raise Isaac back from the dead, and that Isaac acts as a type of Christ. And there's a lot of connections between Isaac and Christ, and that Isaac was Abraham's hope. It's the son that God could only give supernaturally, and Christ is our hope, the son that God could only give supernaturally. Both died and rose again, so to speak. Isaac, typically, or as a type, Christ, really, historically. They both enacted a covenant, and there's a lot more, but I failed to write it down, and my memory is gone right there. But the Abraham thing kind of climaxes with Isaac, which we talked about last week. And so now we've got what looks like three chapters of loose ends that just kind of end this narrative. It just seems kind of like, let's toss a couple of random biographical information in here. But if you look at it, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're all patriarchs in Genesis. And if you look at the end of their narrative, they all have this same kind of structure. So the author of Genesis knew what he was doing. It wasn't just like, let's just throw in some background information because I need to take up three chapters. And you see connections between Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the way the narratives end, they always end, they talk about the death and the burial of a wife. They talk about the marriage of the sons. They talk about, there's a list of descendants. There's the death and the burial of the patriarch. There's another list of descendants, and then the next generation starts up. So, tonight we're looking at Genesis 22 through 25, starting after the sacrifice of Isaac. And it looks like these things are just kind of random tidbits after what was a climax. Right? We've got this list of names, these random family members, how are they connected? We have the death and burial of Sarah. We have getting a wife for Isaac. We have Abraham's death and another list of random names. How do they all fit together? What's the point of this? How do these connect to Genesis 12? Genesis 12, which talks about God saying, I'm going to make you a great nation. I will bless you. Abraham's supposed to be a great nation. Nations need land. Abraham's supposed to be a great people. He said, your descendants are going to number the stars. And he does kind of have a fair amount of kids, but they're not, nothing like a, seashore or star-like, either or. So what's going on here? Let's look at this. What these things do is it's really kind of a transition. It's Abraham's promises transitioning into Isaac. This is really a turn. It's no longer really about Abraham, even though it's the end of his narrative. It's really setting us up for his son Isaac. And we can see that in these four sections. And I'm going to kind of divide them up in four sections, and we're going to look at them, draw some insights from them, and see theologically how they're connecting to Abraham's original promise of seed and land. Let's look at this first one, Genesis 22, verse 20. Now it came about after these things that it was told to Abraham, saying, Behold, Milcah also has borne children to your brother Nahor. Uz, his firstborn, and Buz, his brother, and Kemuel, and the father of Aram, and Chesed, and Hazo, and Pildash, and Jidlaf, and Bethuel. Bethuel became the father of Rebekah. These eight Milcah born to Nahor, Abraham's brother. His concubine, whose name was Rumah, also bore Teba, and Gaham, and Tahash, and Maacah. And some of those names are kind of interesting, and if you're into geography, I could drop another map and put some flags down, but that's not really the point of this. The point of this is I want to talk about how this is setting things up, setting up the idea of seed. This is really like a segmented family tree. If you try to draw it out, it's going to look like you're from the Appalachia Hill Country of West Virginia. It's not pretty. I tried doing it and kind of like, I shuddered and I had to put my pencil down and wash my hands. It's not good. I mean, it's not bad, it's just it's kind of like, if you're in the Hill Country of Appalachia, you say, yeah, this is home stuff. And nothing against you if you are from the Hill Country of Appalachia. It's just not how things work in Detroit or modern America. But back then it was all cool and kosher. And I won't put that up there either because that would scare you as well. But basically, Abraham's family was kind of close. And what this is doing, it's setting up Rebecca's background. Usually when we have genealogies, it's this guy, 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 this guy. Maybe we'll toss in a wife occasionally, this guy, this guy. But in the midst of all these guys, we have became the father of Rebecca. We have this girl here. Why? What's the point of this? Who cares? And the author of Genesis is kind of teasing. It's a hint. It's a foreshadow. It's saying, keep your eye on Rebecca. She's from Abraham's land. She's from Abraham's people. And we're mentioning her here. And it's big. And we're going to come back to it. It's just like a little teaser. Like a sneak preview. Like, oh, you see a man in a movie with like a trench coat and a flashlight. And you're like, hey, I know that mysterious figure is going to play important in the climax later on. And that's kind of what this is going on. It's just Rebecca's, oh, it's a one-off name, but she's going to figure in big later on. Just an interesting connection. If you look at this, there's a list of 12 sons. Nahor has 12 sons, 8 by his principal wife, 4 by a secondary wife. Later on, we see Jacob has 12 sons, 8 by a principal wife or wives, 4 by his secondary wives. And we also see Ishmael has 12 sons. No big theological thing there. I just like pointing out how these narratives fit together and the artistic side of things and the beauty of reading the Old Testament. Sometimes we come to this Old Testament and it's just, and we get so lost, can't figure out how to read it. But you can see connections and see things that are done well. And that's one of those, the listing of sons. But Rebecca, something else that's interesting about her is she came from the eighth son. In the ancient Near East and even in a lot of cultures, it's always the firstborn. Right? I mean, it's really sad for the younger brothers and sisters. It never bothered me because I was the firstborn. Like, it was just like something I didn't understand. Like, yeah, of course it goes to me. I'm the firstborn, you know? But, like, I've never had to live with the concept of being a younger brother and having this older brother that gets everything. And not like I'm getting everything, but just, you know, it's like the firstborn concept never really, I was never bothered by that. I always liked that, right? I really, really, it wasn't an issue for me. It's like, yeah, whatever, Sunday school teacher, come on. And, but God always kind of reverses that. He flips it. He just says, no, it's not by might, right, or who happened to be born. It's by my choice, by my election. Rebecca comes from the eighth son here. Genesis completely always rejects, not always, but it's rejection of the idea of the firstborn. And it's God's election. It's Rebecca by the eighth son of this guy. And uncle, aunt, crazy, gnawing family tree, so whatever. But this narrative ties into the next one that we're going to talk about, which is the death of Sarah. And the juxtaposition is really important because Genesis 12, God said, go. Go from your father's land, from the land you know, to the land I'm showing you. And here, after his final test of faith with Isaac, we have this connection back to the old country. Right? Abraham's family, what's going on with his brothers. Hey, you know, your brother's got these kids, you've got these nieces and nephews, and some of them maybe are also your grandparents and that crazy family tree thing. And, you know, here's a report from the old country, because it's reported that Abraham heard this. This is news that he's getting. It's an attempt to tie back to, oh yeah, I've got people back there. As opposed to right here, where I've got some tents and camels, and I happen to have a lot of camels, but back there I've got people. You know, I've got family. And now we go into how he responds to the death. And we're going to look at this narrative. You might have to excuse my reading. My printer kind of did like an 80s ribbon printer thing. Anyone remember those? Like the Apple IIe's and like the hole punches and the... Not really. Maybe you didn't go to elementary school in the 80s. But that's what happened. And this is what it reminds me of. And it's a mess. So, bear with me. Read along. Genesis 23. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of life of Sarah. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Then Abraham arose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying, I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I might bury my dead out of my sight. The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, Hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead. So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, and he spoke with them, saying, If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron, the son of Zohan, for me. Maybe Zohar, that's a smudge. That he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field, for the full price of him. Give it to me in your presence for a burial site. Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even all who went in at the gate of the city, saying, No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead. And Abraham bowed before the people of the land. He spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, If you will only please listen to me, I will give you the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there. Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? So bury your dead. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver, which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field, and within the confines of its border were deeded over to Abraham for possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, before all who went at the gate of the city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah his wife in the cave of the field of Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. Sounds like you just kind of witnessed a business meeting, and maybe that really excited some of you that are into business meetings, and maybe others are like, I really don't care, just buy a field and bury it, and you know, say that you were sad about your wife's death, which you'd only do a little bit. And some people look at this and just say, this is just a legal custom that so-and-so decided to toss in there under some kind of influence, and blah, 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 whatever, and there's absolutely no theological reason behind this. And I think that there is. I think there's something important in this, and it really connects to what had just happened with this mention of all these people in your old land and with what God said in Genesis 12. God told Abraham, you're going to have a promised land. You're going there. This is going to be your land. Abraham went. He's been there a number of years, and you know what? He doesn't have any land. And his wife just died. And you really, you know, they didn't have the whole cute-looking mummy coffin thing going on there, so they kind of had to get those things taken care of rather quickly. What do you do with your dead? You know, and that's kind of an important concept and something I can't really get into, but just the concept of burying your dead and preserving the body, and especially in the New Testament where we believe in the resurrection of the body, that the way we treat our dead is important, where we bury our dead is important. So there's that initial pull of Abraham. He's in a strange land. He calls himself a sojourner there. Yeah, he's done well. He's gotten some princes, not princes, he's gotten camels and tents and all this jazz, but when it comes time to bury your dead, you want to bury someone in a foreign land, in a foreign tomb, among strangers, or could you go back to the home country where you've got aunts, uncles, and grandmas, and nieces, and nephews? And in death, Abraham really acts out in faith. He really says, you know what, I'm going to believe the promises of God. That he said he's going to give me this land. So what Abraham has to do is he has to secure a spot to bury his wife. And this dialogue is really, it's kind of interesting, and it gets, well, we'll get to that in a second. But basically, the purchase of this land, it shows that he's acting in faith in God, and it also firms up a spot for his descendants. Right? Because in the Old Testament, when you die, even now, you know, you have these big family plots and cemeteries, you know, all the way down through, sometimes hundreds of years, and you get these giant crypts. And especially in the ancient Near East, you were buried with your fathers. An expression is, you know, gathered to his people. Doesn't mean, it means buried with your people. So what Abraham wants to do is he doesn't just want somewhere to bury his wife, he wants somewhere that his descendants can be buried as well. Because he believes that the land is going to be his. He believes that even if he's not going to see it in his lifetime, even if he's going to die, still looking towards that promise, his descendants will fulfill that promise. And that's faith, and he's regarded as that in Hebrews 11. He's looked on as an example of faith. Yeah. The other thing is Abraham is really careful in this. In this whole transaction. And those of you that like the business thing, maybe you picked up on some of this, or maybe you happen to be an expert in ancient Near Eastern legal customs, and then you like really picked up on this, and you're like, hey, that Abraham, he went to Wharton Business School of that day. Is Wharton a good business school? It just popped in my head. I don't even know if it's that or like a fishing machine. I don't even know what a fishing machine is. That just popped into my head. So I need to write out what I'm going to say, because it's a mess. Okay, so anyway, Abraham wanted to be above reproach in what he was doing. Back in that society, it wasn't exactly known for literacy, which is not a bad thing. I mean, not everyone learns to read or write. Today, we consider it a very important thing in American culture, but back then, it just wasn't a literal society, literate society. It was an oral society. So they didn't have to write these things down and sign them. They had to do these things in a certain spot, the city gate, in front of a large amount of witnesses, the elders. And they spoke these things out, and sometimes they would give signs to say, this happened, doo-doo-doo. They could get you into trouble later, like when your prostitute relation, son-in-law, daughter-in-law took your, never, that's a different narrative, whatever. All I'm saying is, it wasn't writing, it was speaking. That was pretty literate there. So in this narrative, you have a lot of emphasis on hearing, listen. The eyes, the ears, and that's emphasized a lot because the narrator is trying to show Abraham knew what he was doing and he was trying to make this transaction above reproach. It was a legal transaction, it was a binding transaction. And you can even see that in the way he deals with the characters. The dialogue starts out kind of general and it gets really, really, really specific. Right? He starts out, and it's the people in the place that get more specific. He starts out talking to the sons of Heth, and he just wants a spot to bury his wife. And they say, sure, you know, yeah, just borrow a grave. You know, whatever. But Abraham knew that just borrowing a grave didn't secure a land. God promised him the land, and Abraham was trying to secure that land because he believed in that promise. So the next time it comes to him, you know, he makes a big show of humbling himself. I'm nothing among you. And the people say, oh, no, you are. And, oh, no, I'm nothing. And it's kind of a fun little thing going on there. But the next time is he doesn't talk to the sons of Heth, he talks to the people of the land. And he doesn't just want a burial plot, he wants a certain cave. And they go back, okay, whatever, and then up and down. And then finally he talks to Ephron, and he wants the cave in the field. And they agree on a price, payment is made, it's in front of the witnesses. There's no going back on this. It's illegal, it's a binding thing. Abraham has now secured land. And it's a big land, right? It's not just one burial plot. He's got a cave. And not just a cave, but the field that's around it. not just a field, but there's trees on there, so it's quite a happening place. But it's big, and it's got room to grow because Abraham is trusting on the promises of God for that land. It's not his land now, but he believes he's supposed to be there, so that's why he doesn't take his dead back to the home country that he's just heard about. He stays in this foreign land, secures land, and says, I'm acting in faith on the promises of God. So I think that's kind of what I wanted to address there. Three application points. These aren't mine, but I picked them out, and I thought, hey, those are really good, so I just kind of want to share them with you. I'm not going to develop them fully for the sake of time, but based on this narrative, we see that the people of God will suffer before they receive the promise. Right? God told them, Abraham, I'm going to do all this stuff with you, and his life didn't really echo that. Christ says, you know, I've first been persecuted, you will as well. But the people of God realize that the promises of God extend beyond this life. Hebrews 11 makes that clear. The way Abraham acted makes that clear. And the people of God can demonstrate their faith by reconciling death with the abiding promises. That when we're faced with death, it's really a chance for the people of God to demonstrate our faith. That death is not the final answer, that there's promises beyond death. That when we're given these promises, we're not looking for them necessarily in this country, but for a better country whose architect and foundation is God. So you can chew those over if you want to talk with me afterwards about those. I'd be up for that. But the narrative there is basically showing that Abraham believed he was getting a land, and he acted accordingly, and he secured that land. The next narrative that we come to, I find absolutely fascinating. I think it's really enjoyable. But I really like the way the Hebrew people wrote. It's long, but I really want to read the whole thing. Because I believe that, well, one, the person who wrote Genesis was far better with words than I am. And two, you can actually hear what I'm talking about. It'd be very easy for me to say these things, like, oh, this character did this, that, and the other. And if you can just hear it yourselves, you can probably follow along better. And I know it's long, but I want to read it. I thought about having like a little melodrama, like, hey, you be Abraham, come up here. But like in the first couple chapters, someone has to grab in the inner thigh of someone else, and I figured no one's going to be comfortable with that. So that idea, we'll save that for a sacred narrative. So, follow along. But as we read this, listen for a couple words. Listen for the concept of blessing. Listen for the concept of going. Listen to the way the characters interact with each other, especially the servant, and what the characters look for. And we'll talk about that. I think it's grand. So here we go, Genesis 24. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. You will go to my country and to my relatives and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, suppose the woman is not willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land from where you came from? Then Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me and who swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give you this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath. Only do not take my son back there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning the matter. Then the servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master, set out with a variety of goods of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, to the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by the well of the water at evening time, the time when women go out to draw the water. He said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring. The daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also. May she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this I will know that you have shown loving kindness to my master. Before he finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful, of marriageable age, and no man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Then the servant ran to meet her and said, "Please, let me drink a little from your jar." She said, "Drink, my lord." She quickly lowered her jar to the hand and gave him a drink. Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, "I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking." So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. When the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrist, weighing 10 shekels in gold. And he said, "Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house?" She said to him, "I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor." Again she said to him, "We have plenty of straw and feed and room to lodge in." Then the man bowed low down and worshipped the Lord. He said, "Blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who is not forsaking in his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers." Then the girl ran, told her mother and household about these things. Now Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. And Laban ran outside to meet the man at the spring. When he saw the ring and the bracelets on his sister's wrist, and when he heard the words of Rebekah his sister saying, "This is what the man said to me," he went to the man, and behold, he was standing by the camels at the spring. And he said, "Come in, blessed of the Lord. Why do you stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for the camels?" So the man entered the house. Then Laban unloaded the camels, and he gave straw and feed to the camels and water to wash his feet and the feet of the men who were with him. But when the food was set before him to eat, he said, "I will not eat until I have told my business." And he said, "Speak." So he said, "I am Abraham's servant. The Lord has greatly blessed my master so that he has become rich. And he has given him flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys. Now Sarah, my master's wife, bore a son to my master in her old age. And he has given him all that he has. My master made me swear, saying, 'You shall not take a wife for my sons from the daughters of the Canaanites in whose land I live. But you shall go to my father's house and to my relatives and take a wife for my son.' I said to my master, 'Suppose the woman does not follow me.' He said, 'The Lord before whom I have walked will send his angel with you to make your journey successful. And you will take a wife for my son from my relatives and from my father's house. And you will be free from my oath. When you come to my relatives, if they do not give her to you, you will be free from my oath.' So I came to David this spring, and I said, 'O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, if now you will make your journey which I go on successful, behold, I am standing by the spring. And may it be that the maiden who comes out to draw, and to whom you say, "Please let me drink a little water from your jar," and she will say to me, 'Your drink, and I will draw for your camels also,' let her be the woman who the Lord appointed for my master's son." Behold, I had finished speaking in my heart. Before I had finished speaking in my heart, behold, Rebekah came out with her jar on her shoulder and went down to the spring and drew. And I said to her, "Please let me drink." She quickly lowered her jar from her shoulder and said, "Drink, and I will water your camels also." So I drank, and she watered the camels also. And then I asked her, "Whose daughter are you?" She said, "The daughter of Bethuel, Nahor's son, who Milcah bore to him." And I put the ring on her nose and the bracelets on her wrist. And I bowed low and worshipped the Lord and blessed the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who had guided me in the right way to take the daughter of my master's kinsman for his son. So now, if you are going to deal in loving kindness and truth with my master, tell me. And if not, let me know that I may turn to the right or the left." Then Laban and Bethuel replied, "The matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you bad or good. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken." When Abraham's servant heard the words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. The servant brought out articles of silver and articles of gold and garments and gave them to Rebekah. He also gave precious things to her brother and to her mother. Then he and the man who were with him ate and drank and spent the night. When they arose in the morning, he said, "Send me away to my master." But her brother and mother said, "Let the girl stay with us a little while, a few days, say 10. After that she may go." He said to them, "Do not delay me, since the Lord has prospered my way. Send me away so that I may go to my master." And they said, "Well, we'll call the girl and consult her wishes." Then they called Rebekah, and she said and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she said, "I will go." Thus they sent away their sister Rebekah and her nurse with Abraham's servant and his men. They blessed Rebekah and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." Then Rebekah rose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now Isaac had come from going to Beer Lahai-Roi, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went up to meditate in the field toward evening, and he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, "Who is that man walking in the field to meet us?" And the servant said, "He is my master." Then she took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife. And he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. I like that narrative. I think there's a lot going on there. And if that was too much Bible for you in one sitting, just be thankful you weren't there when Moses read the whole Pentateuch to the people, because that was, you know, goodness gracious, endurance. That's like a marathon, man, original. None of the swimming in the ocean. But I just think it's a great narrative. There's a lot going on there, and there's a lot I could talk about. And I'm not qualified to talk about a lot of it. There's things going on there which has always been can't think of that word right now. Guys sit around, get their BAs, and then work at Starbucks. Philosophers. That's what it is. You know, they talk about the whole issue of human responsibility and divine sovereignty. You know, just the issue of God's providence orchestrating all these situations, and also the human walking rightly with responsibility, just all that going on in this narrative. Ancient Israelites would love to tell this to their children, also as an example of how arranged marriages would work out. You know, like, don't be scared. Look, it worked out great for Isaac and Rebecca. It'll work out great for you. We've got a good one coming. You know, it's kind of like the bedtime story, the reverse German fairy tale. You know, don't go into the woods. This is like, hey, it doesn't matter. We'll pick a good wife for you. So there's that. And I'm not going to get into, like, the Jewish history of this narrative, because that'd be crazy, too. But I want to look at the way the characters deal with each other. And just the things here that Abraham, in the last narrative, he's secured that land. It's a burial plot, but it's also got a field around it. He's believing the promises of God. That's the land. But there's also that seed, the idea of being a great nation. And yes, he's had some other kids. There is Ishmael, there's some others that we're going to hear about soon, but he knows that Isaac is the elect one. Isaac is the child of promise. Isaac is his spiritual offspring, and in a sense, he's really his only offspring. It's through Isaac that the promise is coming. So Isaac's got to get some kids, so Abraham's got to find Isaac a wife. And so he works a deal with his servant and says, go. So Abraham is preparing for Isaac. This is all about a transition from Abraham to Isaac, and Abraham's last act shows that. And the servant is just a great guy. I mean, he's just like a really, really clever kind of guy. And he faithfully serves. Abraham gives him something to do, and he faithfully does it. He's dependent upon God. This is actually the servant's prayer. It's the first prayer in Scripture to God asking for help in a specific instance. First one. It's kind of interesting to note. And he's just this really clever guy in the way he selectively retells what has been told him. It's not being dishonest, but it's looking at who these people are and telling the truth in kind of an interesting light. It's clever. He's being clever. He's being wise. There's a flip side of that, which is kind of being shifty, and I don't think he's being that at all. But I'll talk about that in a little bit. Rebecca, when we're introduced to her, she's just this great person. First of all, her name. Her name is kind of a pun on blessing. Her name possibly means cow, which is not so cool. But in the Old Testament, a lot of women's name meant things with animals. You know, there's like cow and sheep, and except Jonah meant dove, which is kind of like the exception to the rule. So her name, maybe not so cool, but it sounds a lot like Barak, which didn't really mean to say that either, but that's what it is, which means in Hebrew is to bless, which is crazy. And there's a lot of pun on blessing, because in Genesis 12, God says, I'm going to bless you, make a great name for you, make you great descendants. And so we have this concept of blessing going on. If you heard, there's blessing a lot, and I tried to emphasize it, but you know I'm not the most expressive fellow, but it occurs a lot in here. And every time you hear Rebecca's name, that ties into blessing. And also, when the servant makes the camels kneel down, it's just this crazy word and a crazy phrase, it also sounds a lot like blessing. So there's just this concept being picked up. So Rebecca, we like her just before we even meet her. You know, she's been foreshadowed in Genesis 22, and now we're finally meeting her. And she's just very, very busy, busy, like an industrious little bee. But her name means cow, so an industrious little cow. But she's rushing. She's quick. She's running. It says all these things, right? She quickly fills up the water. She rushes to the camels. I should actually find it because I'm going to mess things up. Yeah, she quickly lowered her jar. She quickly emptied her jar. At the end, she ran to her mother quickly. And it's just this thing where the servant had this idea of, okay, God, I'm trusting in you to bring this girl to me. And then when this girl comes, it's like exceeding any kind of expectations she could have had. Not only is she from the people, she's like from the people, right? Her two of Abraham's brothers are in her line. That's that crazy cross in the family tree I was talking about. You know, she's like Abraham's family, family. And not only is she Abraham's family, family, she does what the servant said, God, you know, I'd really like this girl to do this, so then I know it's from you. She gave him some drink, and then she watered the camels, which is no small task, because camels have those big water reservoirs in them, like 25 gallons each, somebody said. They got 10, that's 250 gallons of water for these hungry, thirsty camels, and she's doing it quickly, right? So it's just one of those things where family connections, and she's like, worker, worker, this is a great person for Isaac. And it helps that she's, you know, beautiful, of marriageable age, and all that jazz, you know, and the Old Testament really does emphasize beauty a lot, so it's you know, kind of icing on the cake. So we got some good things going on here. And he gives her some gifts, and they take her back to the family. Rebecca, we like. Rebecca's cool. She quickly rushes to the camel. She quickly rushes with the jars. We meet Laban. And Laban is not the clever fellow like the servant. Laban is the shifty fellow, right? I think when we first meet Laban, later on, if you know the Joseph narrative, no, Jacob, there we go, let's get that straight. He causes some problems later on. And we're introduced to that now, because when Laban rushes out, and when Laban is quick, Laban is noticing some things, and it's not thirsty camels, he's noticing camels. This guy's got 10 camels with him. It'd be like somebody pulling up to your house with 10, with like a really nice car, like those Bentley things. Is that even a car? I'm so out of it. Those cars that are like handmade that they make like 4 a year. Like, pretend he's got 10 of those pulling up to the house. Okay, camels, we think everyone had a camel in the ancient Near East, right? You know, it's like a car here. No, they were pretty rare at this point in time. So the fact that this servant is traipsing in with 10 of them, that means there's more back in Abraham's land, so Laban just notices camels. There's some money here. And he notices the bracelets and the ring on Rebecca. And you look at what Laban notices. Laban rushes to the gold. He sees the money. And they don't really like Laban so much. I shouldn't say that. I never met the guy, but he's just, we don't have a favorable opinion of him based on what he's doing in this narrative. And I'm missing like 7 pages right now. So I can't give you the specific details unless I can learn how to count again. There we go. Yeah. He saw the camels. He saw the ring. He saw the bracelets. He saw the man. Behold, he was standing by the camels. There's just this emphasis on Laban looking at riches. And so how does the servant address that? When the servant addresses what Abraham said to him, the servant says, "The Lord has blessed my master greatly. He has become rich. He has flocks and herds and silver and gold and servants and maids and camels and donkeys." He addresses Laban knowing what's going to appeal to Laban, which is money. And later on, he also addresses the aspect of the Lord that I prayed for these things to happen, and they happened. God has dealt with loving kindness towards Abraham. God has dealt with loving kindness towards me, the servant. And now, Laban, are you going to deal with loving kindness towards me and my master? In a sense, are you going to be like God to us? Are you going to deal with us as God has dealt with us? Or are you going to not do that? So Laban's hands are kind of tied. The servant's pretty clever there. And Laban says, yes, you know, if it's from the Lord, I can't say anything one way or the other. But he does. Laban seems to consent to this marriage, but then when it's time to go, Laban says, well, I don't know yet. Let's see what Rebecca wants to do. Let her just stay here a little while, you know, 10 days. And that doesn't really mean 10 days, you know, like there was some magical thing happening 10 days later, like her aunt's birthday party that she just couldn't leave before, and then she had to get her hair curled, and then after that she can go with you. It was just 10 days was an expression saying, you know, a few days, few hours, few years, you know, something. Let's not rush into anything quickly. And we see Laban doing that again later with Jacob. He's there for 20 years, you know, a few days as well. Yeah, just the way that these characters are interacting with each other. But Rebecca parallels Abraham, because she was supposed to go, and then Laban tries to weasel out of it and says, well, let's bring it to Rebecca. Rebecca, what do you want to do? Genesis 12, and he went. Genesis 25, 24, I will go. It's the same verb. They're paralleling each other. Abraham left the comfort of what was known to follow the God of promise. Rachel is leaving what is known to follow the God of promise. The author is trying to parallel them. Yeah. They go there. I found this interesting, and it goes with the parallel as well, that she sees Isaac. Who is this? He's my master. So then in Genesis 24:67, then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. Having just recently seen Psycho, the only thing I could think of is Norman Bates. I was like, what is this creepy Isaac guy doing? Like, come meet my mother. You know, I was like, why are you bringing this girl into your dead mother's tent? Like, hello. Maybe the deeding scene didn't really bring him up to snuff on how you're supposed to cover things. He's going to put a wig on and pretend to be his mother and say, hey, Rebecca. You know, I didn't get it. I was like, what is going on? And some of you were looking at me like, I'm crazy and I'm the psycho now, which is good. But basically, there's a point to why he brought Rebecca into his dead mother's tent. And it's that parallel thing that if this is a transition from Abraham to Isaac, it's also a transition from Sarah to Rebecca. Sarah is now the matriarch of the promised family, of the covenant family. And Rebecca goes into Sarah's tent. She is, in a sense, taking Sarah's spot. She's replacing Sarah. Not in a weird way, not in a creepy way, but in the promised way. That we now have the patriarch in Isaac and the matriarch in Rebecca. And they're continuing God's promises. Even though Abraham and Sarah died having not yet received that promise, looking for a better country, that promise now continues through their offspring. So yeah, and you see that. This narrative opens with Abraham's last activity, securing a wife. It closes with the memory of Isaac's mother, and it really puts them out of the picture, and it's setting us up for Isaac is on his own now. It's Isaac who will be blessed by God. And the next part, and then we'll maybe come back to here depending on time. Genesis 25. This is the final close to this huge, long Abrahamic narrative section. Genesis 25. Now Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. She bore to him Zimram and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dadan. And the sons of Dadan were Asherim and Letushim and Limumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah and Afer and Hanok and Abidah and Eldaah. All these were the sons of Keturah. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. These are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. And he gathered to his people, Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephrah, the son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre. The field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. And there Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. It came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac. And Isaac lived by Be'er Lahoi Roy. This narrative is out of chronological order. It's not that after Isaac came back, Abraham took another wife and then had all these children. It seems like this maybe occurred earlier, but the narrator is putting it there, tying up with all the loose ends. What's showing is that Abraham had some other offspring, but they weren't the children of promise. They were ancient Near Eastern things worked a little bit differently. Namely, they had a bunch of wives, and so there was a primary wife, and the blessings and the wealth went to that primary son, and then there were secondary wives or concubines. They had a lesser legal status, so Abraham didn't have to share these things with him, but it's showing how Abraham dealt with all these other sons. He didn't just kick them to the curb. He gave them gifts, which the father either could do, the patriarch either could do or couldn't do, and he sent them on their way. Because he was setting Isaac up, saying, this is who the promise will continue through. He dealt rightly and justly with all his other sons, but the promise, the hope, was on Isaac. And that kind of concludes Abraham's life. And there's many tribes that came out of him. There were many nations, but only one carried the covenant. And then you can see that in verse 11, that God blessed his son Isaac. The blessings continue. The promises continue. Isaac is the elect line. That's kind of a complete transition from Abraham to Isaac. And we're going to look in the next couple weeks at Ishmael and his lineage and Isaac and his lineage. And the enmity that exists somewhat between there, and also how God's promises to Abraham continue. I'm going to look, just read Hebrews 11, which summarizes Abraham's life from a faith aspect and the promise aspect. Hebrews 11:8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, many descendants, as the stars of heaven in number, innumerable as the sand which is on the seashore. All these died in faith, without having received the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, "In Isaac your descendants shall be called." He considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. Abraham walked in faith. He hadn't received the promises, but he believed the promises didn't end with death. And that's something that, I guess, personally, that I've been thinking through a lot, too, that the life of the faithful doesn't always end well, on this side of things anyway. The life of the faithful doesn't always end in this clear light. You know, things don't always pan out. They don't. People say, it'll pan out. It'll come together. Maybe not. Abraham died believing in God's promises, even though they hadn't been in this country. Because he didn't think that God's promises were bound to happen in this country. He was looking towards the next country. And he knew that's where things would be fulfilled. That's where things would be made right. And that's how we need to walk as well. Realizing that the promises of God don't end in this life, but they extend to the next. The promises of God don't end with us, but his program continues on to those who come after us. And part of being faithful to God is also making sure that the programs of God continue on with the next generation. Four other points that I thought were good that aren't original to me, but things that were taken out of this narrative. That believers have that responsibility of ensuring that God's program continues to the next generation. Abraham secured a wife for Isaac, knowing that he didn't have these many nations he was promised, but believing that promise, securing it for his son, that the promise would live on through him. Believers can be confident that the Lord will lead them
and their faithful activities. Believers may rest assured that the Lord will complete the goal, the good work that He has begun. We're confident that God is going to lead us. We might not see how or where till after. But Abraham believed in the promise, and he walked by faith. And he set it up so that his son could believe in that promise and walk by faith. And today, we're to believe that promise and walk by faith. It's not always easy. It's not always clear. That's what living by faith is. So let's pray. Father, I thank you for your word. I thank you for the clarity in your word, for the hope and light it can give us into our lives in the times of uncertainty. Thank you for the promise that you gave to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. Thank you for the promise that you gave to us through Christ, which is a far greater promise. Pray that this week we walk faithfully in light of the promise which is ours. We will be faithful, that we will serve you and love you in this life, knowing that your promises extend to the next. It's in your name I pray. Amen.